For now, we're going to go to Raphael Lupekine, I believe, and I'm not sure if I mangled your last name. I apologize. Are you there?
Yeah, a slight mangle. It's Lupekine.
Lupekine. All right. My apologies. Now, I ended up meeting you at a Green Drinks event, which I like to mention every once in a while because those are great events, and I think anyone who lives in the Toronto area can come down and meet me or Leah or any one of our other volunteers that occasionally makes it their way down there. There are also Green Drinks events that happen all over the place, so it's a really great way to go and network and meet other like-minded folks, other like-minded professionals. Today we're going to be talking to you about, first of all, you're coming from the aspect of starting the Canadian Environment, which is the CAEN.ca, did I get that right?
Yeah, that one you got right.
And, okay, one for two ain't bad, I'll take it.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So, and that's like an environmental news aggregating site, and we'll get back and let you talk a little bit more about the site a little bit later. But first of all, we wanted to get you on today because you had an op-ed in the British Columbia edition, if you will, of the Huffington Post called Northern Gateway is the Wrong Fight. Just to start off, just generally, do you want to just quickly outline the article?
Sure. I mean, I think the title is, you know, it doesn't quite fit the argument. I had a long debate with myself about what the title should be, and I went with that. I think a more accurate title would probably be The Northern Gateway is the Wrong Type of Fight, I think is probably better.
Mm-hmm.
But basically my argument is that, so the oil industry wants the Northern Gateway pipeline because they have shuttered oil that they can't get to market, and there's a serious price differential from $40 a barrel. And that is as a result of a oil glut in the U.S. Midwest, which has resulted from, one, the expanding oil sands, and two, because of increase of shale oil, tight oil that has been extracted in the U.S. And so there's a bottleneck there. And as a result of that bottleneck, the prices are too high, so they need new pipelines. And so the Northern Gateway pipeline was proposed to do that, to send oil to the West Coast, to Asia, and then there. And so that's the big battle, and that's where we had a lot of news about it, and it's the focus of lots of campaigns, and the media's all over that story, and the public is, as I lay out in the article, is gripped by it, but. I sort of took a step back and I was wondering, well, okay, well, where does this sort of fight go from here? And, granted, the Northern Gateway Pipeline has a lot of negatives associated with it that is really hard to support, from, going through over sensitive waterways, I think something like 800, and, this has all been not well monitored by the government, by DFO. They have no real idea of the impact of all that crossing, and then we have impacts on endangered species. We have opposition by First Nations. There's also the threat to the pristine coast in that area, and so Gateway, it doesn't really make a lot of sense, and that's fine. But my sort of argument is that the victory here shouldn't be necessarily viewed as a blueprint to success, overall. I think that there are a number of other pipeline proposals in the Canada and the U.S. that will help achieve what Gateway is aiming to achieve, that is, reduce the glut of oil. And so, beyond Gateway, then what happens is, there's these other fights to be had, and I just sort of think that, we're going to, if the groups are going to be engaged with trying to stop each one of these pipelines, it's just going to be more and more sort of fragmenting the conversation, and then the conversation is about the safety and security of pipelines, and, if you have a heart attack, you don't, deal with the veins, you deal with the heart, and what are the causes of that? So, then I go. So that's the sort of core piece of the argument. And
so, if I can actually just stop you there, because I think that you hit the nail on the head as far as what I wanted to ask you first about, which is the idea of the whack-a-mole. You've been following this quite a bit. I've been following it as well. I don't know if your assessment will be the same as mine, but it seems to me that throughout all of these fights, whether you're talking about Gateway or Keystone or any of these other pipeline, Trans-Canada Gas Pipeline, Enbridge's Line 9, any of these, is that it seems to be not relatively that difficult to get people excited about being a part of opposition to a specific project. But when you back it up to the bigger picture, as you're saying, the heart of the problem, you don't find that there's as much traction. Do you feel that this is because of a lack of information, or if there's an aspect of people's opposition to these pipelines that is not just environmental, but also NIMBYism, as in there's, you know, the people who get excited about specific pipelines are contributed to by people who are going to live near those pipelines. And that's why it's maybe harder to get as much support on a national level for a just kind of generally, you know, opposing projects in general, as opposed to a specific pipeline. Do you get that same feeling?
I mean, yeah, when you look at the projects and what's happening, that's definitely an undercurrent. And, you know, it's not easy to get people interested in these things and, hey, to get a rally about, you know, putting a price on carbon. You know, not that maybe that's ever been tried, but, you know, that doesn't really bring people out. There's no doubt about it. So I understand from that, you know, point of view, you got to go where the people are, and this is an aspect that, you know, it's brought the issue to the forefront of the table. But, you know, I think my sort of point was, like, let's take a step back and, you know, where does this fight actually go if we, you know, successful, but what, you know, what's the end result? And I just didn't see the end result being what is really needed to turn the economy around. I mean, I suppose there's an argument to be made that, you know, if there is a real progressive movement to stop the growth of pipelines, and this then forces the oil industry to recognize there's a deep disconnect between what they're trying to achieve and what the public is saying, that could turn into greater political pressure to develop solutions where, you know, this type of public anger doesn't occur, and, you know, the oil industry can go back to its business, or perhaps not its full business, but a segment of its business that doesn't, you know, bring this kind of outburst of the public. I mean, you know, in Norway, obviously, it's like, you know, the great progressive dream to talk about Norway, but, you know, they have an increasing carbon tax there and an expanding oil industry, and these two, you know, work, you know, the public understands the need for the oil and gas in the midterm, but you know, as a society, has recognized that the future is not going in that direction, and you know, they don't have this kind of anger and opposition to you know, the business of the oil industry. So, I mean, I think that's possible, that's viable, but I just don't think that the type of opposition that exists for Enbridge and you know, arguably for Trans Mountain, the Kinder Morgan pipeline that's proposing to go through Burnaby too. I mean, those two pipelines, you know, don't have as a likely chance to happen as something like Line 9, which, you know, is going to be starting off as bitumen pipeline, but rather a light oil pipeline. But the fear is that it will then, you know, through another application be turned into that, and then another way to export to the export market by either the Maritimes or through Maine. And then there's the Trans-Canada one, which hasn't really been talked about much, reversing the gas pipeline, but that one is another way to again move this oil. And what's happening in the U.S., there's, you know, that's a whole another conversation that, you know, Canada is not a part of, and this whole $40 price differential could easily, well, not necessarily easily, but could very well disappear if, you know, all the projects in the U.S. go ahead, or more projects developed to move that oil, because this isn't just a Canadian problem, it's also a U.S. Midwest problem. And the opposition there to, you know, move an oil doesn't exist like it does, you know, on the B.C. coast and whatnot. So there's the Keystone is definitely something that's, you know, obviously captured the attention of the U.S. population, but, you know, there could be other projects that just don't really, you know, capture that kind of opposition because it just doesn't bother people whose neighborhood it runs through. So,
speaking of that, just going to back to BC residents for a minute, we're halfway through the article approximately. You have a line here that I found very interesting. I hadn't actually seen the article you're referencing, but the line says half of BC residents who oppose Gateway would support a pipeline with better economic and environmental narrative. What aspect of that then of people's opposition, when we're looking, say, at like maybe poll numbers and that sort of thing, can we really take them at face value then that, you know, oh, look, you know, 20, 40, 60, whatever percent of the Canadian population opposes this pipeline, that those aren't all necessarily opposing them on, I don't agree with pipelines. They're just, I just don't like this pipeline, and that they might actually agree with other pipelines. So it sort of skews, even sort of when you're on this side of it, when, you know, from our perspective, where you're disagreeing with it on a fundamental level, like this is just the wrong direction for society type level, that when you look at people's support or support for being opposed to these projects or opposition to these projects, that it's not necessarily all of those folks are on the same team.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly true. I think that, I mean, you can only look at what's happening in BC with regards to, you know, natural gas. There's extensive extraction in the northwest BC in the St. John's area. You know, a lot of that is shale gas extraction with a lot of environmental negatives associated with it. And they're, you know, ramping up pipelines and LNG proposals to ship gas out of there. And, you know, they have there's a lot more political support, First Nation support, environmental groups. You know, they're not as focused on that because they're focused on Gateway. And so, you know, you can even take that argument and, you know, it's clouding the discussion around what, you know, the coal extraction that's going on in BC as well. So, yeah, I mean, there's this focus on Enbridge, but this one pipeline has just a lot of, you know, really, you know, bad narratives associated with it. And when you start stripping back those narratives, that population opposition, you know, just kind of disappears. And so what does that tell us is that, you know, when we're discussing the safety and security of pipelines, if we make them safer and more secure and we give people more money, then that opposition just isn't as strong. So,
Well, unfortunately, we're getting close to the end of the program. We're running out of time. I've got time for about one more question, which is that if I understood the gist of your article was that, as you were saying before, is just that this is that it's the wrong fight. One of the things we've been asking here on the show, and I'm still waiting to get a good answer. I don't know if you feel like playing devil's advocate for a moment, but I'm still looking for someone to explain to me why oil companies get subsidies, why the richest companies on the planet get money from everyday folks, and that if there is no good answer to that, why isn't that, you know, the narrative that's being pursued rather than opposing individual pipelines?
Yeah, again, and that's a great question. I think you said it earlier. I mean, with regards to why there's no opposition, first, I think that again, it's one of those abstract things. You start talking about money, and you talk billions, millions, and it's just sort of this abstract number. It doesn't really, you know, it's not a pipeline plowing through your backyard or an oil slick, you know, covering your child on its way to work or somewhere on school or something like that. And so I guess, you know, it just doesn't have that kind of traction. And I mean, I don't want to blame NGOs or anything like that to say, oh, they should be, you know, turning all the resources towards these larger ideological or larger narratives when, you know, they're under pressure to perform. They have budgets, they have a certain amount of resources, and they have, you know, a certain amount of a growth mandate where they have to, you know, get their name out and get their work done. And you know, it makes a lot of sense that, you know, they'd gravitate towards projects or, you know, initiatives that attract a lot of attention. So it's
really good for your donors if you can declare victory, and it's a lot more likely that they'll be able to succeed and declare victory against a specific pipeline than against the entire oil industry.
Yeah, I mean, that's an element. I mean, all of these groups, you know, would agree with us, and you know, you look at their websites and they talk definitely about solutions. And I know that the David Suzuki Foundation, they have a counter on their website for the amount of money that the oil industry is getting in subsidies since, you know, the Harper government said that they would, you know, eventually phase these types of subsidies out. And of course, there's been nothing done on that front. But Yeah, I mean, why do they get all this money? Well, you know, I guess it takes money to make money. So that works for government too, I guess.
Maybe I should have booked you for the full show because I have about six more questions I probably could ask you, but I'm afraid we're out of time. I want to just give you a minute if you want to just let people know quickly about your website and where they can contact you and check out your website.
Sure, great. Yeah, so the Canadian Environment, it's thecaen.ca, so thecaen.ca. You can go to it to get the latest Canadian environmental news every day. Myself and a team of volunteers, we publish quick sort of summaries of the top news of the day, so you can get informed and understand what's happening in your neighborhood or the entire country. You can also find tweets from some of the top Canadian actors and blog aggregation of the main NGOs in Canada. And you can contact me through the website. We have a contact form, and you know we're on Twitter and Facebook, and we welcome any feedback.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Raphael.
Yeah, this is great. I'd like to come back, so we'll talk soon.
Absolutely, absolutely. Maybe we'll book a whole show off on trying to explain oil subsidies, but we'll have to save that for another day. All right, thanks so much.